Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
I'm Mark Settle. I am a seven-time CIO and two-time book author, and I'm currently located in Silicon Valley, where I advise a number of different startup companies.
Mark, thanks so much for making time joining us on the Ivy Podcast. Very excited to talk about the current projects, the book, all of that great stuff you've been working on. But before we do that, give me a thumbnail version of your career.
Well, you know, the thumbnail, seven times at the wheel of leading an IT organization, all for Fortune 1000 companies, Fortune 500 companies. I've been out in the Valley here for more than two decades and have over time developed relationships with a lot of venture capital firms and stayed pretty plugged into the local tech community here as well. So, you know, it's kind of the best of both worlds.
Wow, that's super exciting. Thumbnail it is, right? So you've been based in the Valley most of your career, or just?
I've had a home here. We moved out here right around 2000. I actually had jobs in Houston and New York and Denver over that period of time as well. So the home base has been here, but I've had work apartments outside the area.
Right. Wow, that's great. That's awesome. So I'm pretty sure you've seen the industry, especially, you know, from the Valley perspective, go through all kinds of different directions, iterations. So definitely want to dive a little bit deeper in terms of your perspective from that standpoint. But before we do that, tell us a little bit about, you know, you've mentioned books, you're an author. What's the latest book that, you know, you had worked on? What's the mission behind this? Tell us a little bit more about it.
I always love to talk about the books. So the most recent one is called Truth from the Valley. And it's meant to be kind of a strategy guide for CIOs. And it tries to step back and look at some of the secular trends that are happening in the IT industry, you know, around things like software engineering and development, infrastructure in the cloud, security issues, like a whole gamut of different changes that are happening. They're fundamentally changing how we go about delivering IT services. And then really encourage people to sort of think about what are the trends that are most impactful to my company and the industry that I work in, because you can't be best of breed in like 20 different things. You've got to place your bets and figure out where to focus your organizational energies and resources. And so that's really the purpose of the book is to help IT leaders, you know, take a more strategic approach to investing in the organizational competencies of their groups.
Uh-huh. Well, that definitely seems very relevant, especially to the current times. So is that based on your personal, you know, practical experience as you were the CIO of multiple companies? What is it based on? Give us a little bit of an in-depth glimpse into that.
Yeah, I love that question because, you know, in some ways you're enabled and limited by your experience, right, all at the same time. And the benefit, again, that I've had working both nationally and in lots of different locations, developing relationships, but having the home base here is I have developed a pretty extensive network of professional, you know, contacts at an executive level. And so I have learned far more by talking to my peers than I have through my own work experience. You know, it's quite a broad cross section. It's also interesting working with the startup companies, seeing where some of their ideas and concepts gain traction and then where they do not. So that gives you some insight into, you know, trends that are really going to have a big impact in the future.
Well, that's super interesting. And you're absolutely right in terms of the past experience. It could be, you know, it could be advantage, could be a disadvantage. Depends on the circumstance or the situation you're in. So speaking of the kind of from personal past experience, one area that really comes to mind that I think is fascinating because it's very challenging, it's very difficult. And what I'm talking about is interviewing. When you find the right talent and you get into the interview, I've seen a lot of interviews being based on that past experience, which is very flawed in a sense that you're not focusing on what's the strength that's missing on the team. Versus, you know, what is the weakness that I can tolerate in that particular candidate or the individual? Tell me a little bit more about your approach towards interviewing. How do you succeed in that space? How do you ensure that you improve the batting average when it comes to meeting the candidate for the first time? What are some of the questions that you like to ask? And more importantly, what do you look for in the responses when you talk to a prospective candidate?
Yep. So, you know, you raise a good point. You can, your own personal experience can sometimes jade the way you approach an interview. And, you know, at this stage of my career, probably for the last 10 years or longer, I really don't interview anymore for technical skills because there are people in my teams that, you know, are far more up to date technically. And if you're coming to talk to me, you've already passed some kind of hurdle with regard to your technical knowledge. And so the things that I really tend to interview for are, you know, organizational skills, people leadership capabilities, and frankly, something that's kind of not talked about so widely, but your ability to navigate organizational politics and a diverse range of executive personalities. You know, whether you're at a manager level, a director level, or a VP level, you know, you've got peers in the business that are operating at comparable levels, and you have to be able to work constructively to have an impact. And so, you know, it's important to find that, make that connection and understand. A couple of tips and tricks, you know, I think the candidate's also always supposed to be doing most of the talking, and yet it's remarkable how many times the interviewer feels this compulsion to share their frustrations or their perception of the job or their own career experience at the company, et cetera. And at the end of the hour or, you know, whatever the encounter time is, they've done most of the talking and the interview ends and they realize, gee, I didn't really learn that much about the candidate, but I think I helped the process along. So I think that's kind of a mistake. And one of the other key things that I look for, I think the way people respond to questions tells you a lot about their thought process. And so if they have a hard time actually answering the question you asked, like the answer doesn't really seem to directly respond to what you wanted to know, or if to get to an answer, they have a, you know, a really kind of a convoluted thought process, then I worry about, you know, the way that they actually think and how they approach problems.
Yeah, that's, you know, I like that framework in a sense, approaching that with an opportunity to create a two-way street with the candidate where they also get an opportunity to ask the right questions, make their own assessment. If you're the right leader they want to be associated with, is this the right culture for them to be, you know, for them to succeed in?
So you've raised a good point. I mean, the questions that the candidate asks are some of the most revealing elements of the interview process in two ways, right? So in one way, it shows, have they done some homework? Did they put the effort into trying to understand your company, you personally, the business challenges that you're facing, et cetera? So that's one, did they do the homework? And then by the nature of the questions, you get some insight into their experience. Like, are they savvy enough to realize that building a machine learning group from scratch in a company that makes tractors is gonna, you know, involve some change management? And can they ask questions about that kind of a scenario that shows you that, you know, their experience is sufficient to prepare them for some of the challenges that they may face?
Right, absolutely. I think, you know, it's an interesting space. We could probably talk about the rest of the episode about this, but I love your framework when it comes to, you know, interviewing from that standpoint. In terms of your current, you know, the roles that you play as an advisor, as a board member to a lot of the startups, tell me a little bit more about, you know, the kind of the why are you getting in this space? What's so interesting to you in terms of paying it forward, or, you know, you using your experience from the past as a technology executive now helping the entrepreneurs, you know, build and scale their, you know, technology teams or the overall companies? And what are some of the strategies that really help you succeed in that space? Because running a corporation, a large division of Fortune 1000 company is one thing, but when you're involved maybe with a smaller startup or a company that's just starting out, it's probably a different approach. Talk to us a little bit from that perspective.
You'd be surprised at the number of people that start companies that are trying to solve problems that they've, in some cases, never experienced personally. They have a perception about the, you know, the pain or the difficulty involved in some aspect of IT operations or business operations. And so they go off to solve the problem and they really just I mean, quite truthfully, they lack the practical insight into being able to take their technical idea. So they may be blockchain experts, they may be AI experts, you know, they may have tremendous technical skills, and they may actually have stumbled onto an area of recurring pain where that technology that they're good at is directly applicable. But their ability to, like, you know, make the connection between those two worlds, the technical capabilities that they're intimately familiar with and the business problem that they're trying to go solve, there's a big gap sometimes. And so I think that's, you know, where somebody like myself, and I'm certainly not unique in that regard, can add a lot of value and kind of really enjoy both sides of the conversation, because, you know, you really feel like you're bringing something to the party that they value. And, you know, I get better educated all the time in the process.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's, you know, especially when it, from investment standpoint, the, you know, I'm involved with a lot of startups myself as well. And some of the best opportunities that really do come about is when you come not only as an investor, but as the value add investor or value add, you know, advisor to the company, where you can utilize not only your experience or the, you know, the kind of the things that you have done, but also your network. The power of the network is very powerful in the sense, here's a type of introductions that I can make for you. And how you operate when you make that introduction, I think says a lot about you as a founder, as an entrepreneur, as a CEO. What are you seeing out there in terms of the companies that you advise on when it comes to the founders or the CEOs that run these companies? What advice do you give them? I realize it's a very loaded question and very broad, but in a sense, to be able to, you know, go from a two-person team to managing a couple thousand people, obviously you need that ability to scale, grow, you know, along with the way your company is growing. What are your thoughts on that? What are some of the areas to consider?
Yeah, so there's some advice there, both on inside and outside. So on the inside, exactly to your point, companies can grow very rapidly. I mean, you could, there's companies here, they're hiring, I don't know, like 100 people a week almost, or maybe like 30 to 50 people a week. And you really need to make the transition where you're bringing in talent, you know, from larger companies that have been there and done that. So, you know, when you're small and initially growing from 10 people to 100 people or 200, there's typically a lot of fluidity in the company. So somebody could start in, you know, sales, move over into marketing, might be interested in a customer success support type job, could even land in HR, you know, if they had really great people skills and want to get out of the front office and move into kind of back office operations. But as you grow, you know, you want people that have performed in those roles for companies that are 3, 4, 5 times your current size. And so sometimes we call that like the ability to look around a corner, like, you know, what's going to happen when we get to like 5,000 customers, even though we only have 500 customers today. And you can start taking steps in terms of, you know, in IT, putting in systems and processes that can support larger, more diverse, potentially even global operations. So, you know, that's having that, bringing people in, and there's a resistance to this because obviously a lot of the folks that were around at the beginning of the company had invested a tremendous amount of sweat equity in getting it to where it is. And they feel like they should be rewarded, you know, for that effort by being given some of the more senior jobs and roles that exist. But for the sake of the company and really for the sake of their own development, everybody's better off to bring in folks, you know, that can both develop the talent that's already there, but prepare for the challenges that'll exist in the future. And then the other comment I wanted to make, you know, I'm going to go back and think about on the outside. One of the bits of advice, this isn't unique to me or profound, but I came up with it. But I think it'll, especially in the early stages of a lot of these companies, you really want your first few customers to be like raving evangelists. Like, you know, to just keep them in, that they should be so referenceable, that they should, you know, get up on the top of the mountain and sing your praises. And to get, you know, how should I put this? I don't want to say confused, but to get distracted in contentious pricing conversations or arguments about functionality or inability to support the initial implementation of your product or service in their environment, because you have so many other demands on your time and the time of your staff. that's the wrong thing to do. You're better off with, let's just say, like 5+ early customers that are seeing your praises than 20 initial customers that might collectively create a higher revenue run rate. So you could say, well, look, I have 20 customers and we're making, I don't know, X amount of money per month, but none of them is really going to be that evangelist that you're looking for. You're much better served by having 8 paying customers, 5 of whom think that, you know, you're the best thing since sliced bread, as we say, right? Yeah.
Right, right. Absolutely. No, that's an interesting observation from this standpoint. So you've seen the industries go from all different trends and cycles, especially when it comes to technology, being the CIO for multiple organizations. In terms of what you're seeing currently, what are you researching? What are you observing as far as trends? Share with us, what are you mostly excited about? What is the next big thing in Mark's research book?
That's a great question too. So there's two topics that I've been spending a lot of time on. One is business process automation. There are a lot of technologies that are available to automate business processes. And I'm particularly interested in companies that are doing this at scale. And what I mean by that is, they've gotten beyond the prototyping or the proof of concept stage. And they're really looking in a very broad way, all the way from like front office sales and marketing to back office, finance and HR, ways to automate day-to-day processes that exist within a company. There's tremendous benefits from doing that. And too often, a lot of these kind of initiatives kind of get stalled out after these initial trial phases or whatever. I mean, some good is actually, business benefits are created, but there are some major companies that have whole organizations that are just dedicated to automation and the results are kind of stunning. So that area really intrigues me. And then the other is, machine learning and AI modeling that's going on. And I'll give you a little more color around that topic. I've devoted a fair amount of my career to building data warehouses in different companies that are used for reporting and business intelligence and, different kinds of insights into the business. And usually the operation of the data warehouses is accompanied by huge debates between IT and the business about how to define certain terms or, consistently apply transformations to data from different source systems that everybody can agree on. And I'm going to over dramatize this a little bit, but, with the advent of data lakes, now you can just put data from a multiplicity of different systems into the data lake. And then you can look at a business user and say, well, what do you want it to be? Like, so wait, you want a list of customers. Well, how do you want to define a customer? I'm not going to force a definition on you. If your idea of a customer is somebody that has spent more than $100 with us in the last year, lives in a zip code where the average income is greater than $80,000 a year, and is in a county that has one of the following, it has either a Louis Vuitton, Saks Fifth Avenue, or Tesla dealership, those are the customers that I want, right? That's the business guy says, that's my idea of a customer. A customer to me is not somebody that spent $5 with us, that's in a zip code where the average income is $50,000 and they don't have any of those kind of high-end stores because we're selling luxury goods. And so you have the flexibility in the world we live today to apply that schema definition to the lake and, do very unique kinds of things and then start to model the behaviors of people that fall into that particular demographic and make some, pretty accurate predictions about their future behaviors. And so it's pretty revolutionary what's going on. And I just contrast that with all of the sweat equity that went into trying to reach agreement with the business about how to define certain kinds of business terms and produce them consistently. And then all the meetings I've been to in my career where we would go in and look at some PowerPoint slides with numbers on them and get into big arguments about whether they were accurate or not, because other people would say, no, that's not right. I looked it up in Salesforce. I just ran this report in Salesforce. That's not the answer that I got at all. Then we have 30 highly paid people are all arguing about why why the two numbers weren't exactly the same. Okay. I think you've been to this movie. I can tell by the chuckling that you're doing.
Yeah.
You're in this. So.
No, that's yeah, I love that. I love that framework. I love that analogy from that perspective. So definitely thank you for sharing that. In terms of your own content diet, besides reading your own books,
I don't do that.
I'm only kidding, because you know I recently my book also recently just came out as well, so I know exactly what you went through in terms of writing that, how hard it is. But as far as the sources that you utilize on daily basis to keep yourself informed, keep yourself educated, you know, ahead of the ahead of the curve, share with us those.
I get a lot of newsletters, you know. Some of the VC firms put out newsletters on like a weekly or monthly basis, and they profile some of the investments that they've made or some of the things that they see have happened in the market. There's, as you know, I mean, you could just drown in kind of newsletters. There's just a ton of services out there. I use Owler as well. It's kind of a news clipping service. So you just designate the companies that are of interest to you and any kind of announcements about them or press releases that they have or made available on a daily basis. So that's a good way to kind of keep up with what's going on. So there's that. There's the personal network too. I mean, I put a high premium on going to events and, you know, sitting in on some CIO forums and whatever, where the information gets exchanged. That's really helpful. Then occasionally a webinar, you know, if there's a topic like maybe that machine learning modeling area that we were talking about, if some kind of new quirky, aspect of that pops up and I see somebody specializing in that, I might spend a little time listening to that as well. So it's a pretty broad cross section. I actually spend more time every day consulting those sources than I really like to admit. I mean, it's pretty easy to sign up, give them your Gmail address, and suddenly there's like 20 things coming in every day, you know, that look potentially interesting.
Right. No, I love this. I'm always fascinated with so much information overload out there, how, you know, strategies to keep your mind, you know, in terms of selection and what you let your mind be exposed to when it comes to content, because it could be a dangerous zone in terms of get information overload or something that's completely irrelevant. So that's pretty cool. Last but not least, what in terms of a book, what are you currently reading? And what is one book that you always recommend to others, and why is that?
So there's a book that I'm pretty high on called Atomic Habits. I don't know if you've heard of that.
James Clear, right?
Yep.
Yeah. I just picked that up a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, good. I think you'll like it. So it really talks about how, you know, most of the time when people want to change their behaviors, it's, let's say, you and I both feel like we're drowning in these, you know, 20 daily emails or whatever, and we can't stop ourselves from opening all 20 emails and then wondering an hour later, like, how did I lose an hour of my workday? Like, how did I let this happen? I was going to be more disciplined about this. I was going to, you know, whatever. I was going to time box it. I was going to start with the most beneficial sources and leave the kind of the spotty ones to the end or whatever it was going to be. And so Atomic Habits is great because it really analyzes your motivations and incentives and personal rewards for your behaviors. And if you start to kind of play around with those, then you can change the behavior as opposed to just saying, oh, I am going to like go to the gym every morning at 6 and say like this. So if you, it helps you change your mindset, give yourself some rewards along the way, and it really can help you do things that seem insurmountable sometimes.
I love that. Love those recommendations. And for our listeners, we'll make those titles available in the show notes. Mark Ken, thank you enough for your time today. It was a very short and, you know, very insightful conversation. I personally learned quite a bit. Definitely, you know, send us a link to where listeners can pick up your book as well, so we can share that. I definitely, you know, I want to pick that up myself and get a little bit of a, you know, more in-depth glimpse into kind of your mindset. What are some of the strategies you recommend? So I really appreciate your time today.
Thanks again.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.